This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. The American economy, the American job market is shifting. People are finding new, innovative ways to make money, sometimes without a permanent employer at all. Uber and Lyft are the commonly known examples, but there are new types of jobs popping up everywhere, from food truck chefs to freelance writers to contract computer programmers. The independent worker is everywhere. Many say we are entering an age where the gig economy, one based on contracted and freelance jobs, will have more workers than the traditional economy, filled with full-time, 40-hour-a-week jobs. That's the subject for this hour of All Sides. It's the gig economy. And joining us to discuss this is Allison Griswold. She's a reporter for Quartz, and she covers the sharing economy. Allison, welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Thanks for having me.
I should mention that I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann this week. And Allison, let's start with the basic definition. What exactly is the gig economy? Because we hear different names for this type of economy.
That's a great question. And like you said, there isn't really a consensus on what to call it. But generally, when people talk about the gig economy, the sharing economy, the on-demand or just-in-time economy, they mean any sort of job that is facilitated through a platform on which the worker is not an employee in the traditional sense, with benefits and minimum wage protection and all sorts of other labor protections, but someone who just contracts with the platform and basically uses it almost as a lead generation tool.
Now, we've had freelance writers and editors and contract consultants for a long, long time. How is this gig economy different than what we've had in the past?
The implicit difference when people talk about it is that it's enabled by technology, usually by apps. So like you said, we've had these sorts of freelance jobs for a long time. Independent contractors are not a new thing. But traditionally, you probably found those jobs by word of mouth or through a listing agency or something like that. And now you have a lot of platforms that basically use your phone to aggregate on one side a bunch of people who need to work and on the other side a bunch of people who want a service. And then the app facilitates that connection. So on Uber, it's you have a bunch of people who are driving cars and a bunch of people who need rides. On another platform called Handy, which is a home cleaning service in New York, you have a bunch of cleaners who are looking for apartments to clean, and then you have a bunch of people who want to hire a home cleaner but don't know where to do it.
We also, apparently there's a pet sitting in New York that's app-based that's causing a lot of problems there. And how many dogs can you take care of at any one time? Is another example of this so-called gig economy. What are the
Right, and that's...
Go ahead.
Go ahead. That's the funny thing about the gig economy is that because it's made it easier to find these jobs in some ways and also just attracted more attention because anytime you frame it as tech, it seems newer and fancier. It sort of started to bring up all these old laws and regulations that before people weren't paying attention to. And now regulators are thinking, do we need to update the laws? Should we continue enforcing it as is? And pet sitting is sort of one of the funnier examples of that.
Yeah. Of course, the pet boarders, they don't like this, what they would call unfair competition from folks. Same with taxi drivers, with the Uber drivers. It's that we have to pay all these licensing fees and meet all these regulations, but an Uber driver may not, or a pet sitter may not have to face those regulations. What are some of the characteristics of gig workers, age and marital status, that kind of thing?
Mm-hmm. So there isn't that much research on them on the whole. There's been a couple different studies that have sort of come out over the last 2 years. They tend to be slightly lower income than the average population. And when you think about gig workers, you really have to divide it between what economists would call sort of a capital platform and a labor platform. And a capital platform is something like Airbnb, where what you're putting on the app or the platform isn't your labor, but it's your asset, right? So with Airbnb, you rent your home, or there's one called Turo, where you rent your car. And those people actually look different on the whole from the people who work for companies like Uber or Lyft, because the people who are renting out something like a home tend to be better off, which makes sense, right? Because you have to have money to buy a home or buy a car. And then you have the other side, which is the people who are driving for Uber or cleaning homes or delivering food. And they tend to be a little lower income. And the defining thing about them is that they usually do these jobs to make up for a shortfall in income. So a typical profile is a person who maybe has another job, but say their hours got reduced, or for whatever reason, they like came up short in their monthly budget. That person might hop onto Lyft and drive for 15 hours until they offset that shortfall in their income.
We're talking about this gig economy filled with part-time workers and contract employees. Our guest right now is Allison Griswold. She's a reporter for Quartz who covers the sharing economy. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We want to hear from you. Are you a member of this gig economy? Are you working on a contract basis? Are you employing people on a contract basis? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Allison, whenever we are coming out of a recession or an economic downturn, the first thing that employers do is they hire part-timers because they don't want to, you know, take the plunge with a full-timer. And then it's just the process of the economy coming back to full employment. Is that what's happening here, that this is all rooted in the Great Recession and all the folks who lost their job and are trying just to make a living, the only way they can do it right now is through these part-time contract gigs?
You know, there hasn't been any definitive research on that, but I think it's a very fair assumption. I mean, if you look at when these companies started, it's all 2008, 2009, 2010. It's very much in that period when people lost their jobs. And if you think about it through that framing, a thing like Uber sounds great, because if you just lost your job and what you need is to just make money as soon as possible, that's basically what Uber came along and offered. They said, you download our app, you start driving tomorrow, you make money by the end of the week. You know, now you make money by the end of the day because the payment turnover is so fast. So I definitely think the recession boosted that economy and sent a lot of people toward those jobs when they didn't have traditional jobs of their own.
How much are these gigs paying compared to regular full-time work?
So again, there isn't that much definitive research on it, but in general, it's really hard to measure because the hours are so variable. So you run the full spectrum from people who work part-time and have another job and are maybe making a couple hundred bucks a week, or to people who are putting in full-time job hours, but on these gig platforms. So in New York, where a lot of the people who drive for Lyft and Uber came over from traditional taxi companies, it's not uncommon for someone to drive for one of those platforms for 50, 60, 70 plus hours a week.
292-8513, area code 614, if you'd like to join our conversation. We're talking about the gig economy with Allison Griswold, reporter from Quartz, who covers this sharing economy. We've talked a lot about Uber and the maid service and the pet sitting service, and those are lower income jobs compared to, say, a freelance writer or a contract IT professional. What's going on in the professional sector of this gig economy?
Well, there are concerns that the shift to gig employment or any sort of staffing-based employment is sort of a downward drag on wages overall. And one of the things you've seen happen, especially with a lot of these startups, is that the money you get paid is less in sort of your base rate and more tied to incentives and special promotions that the company might offer on a week-to-week basis. And those can be really good for people because maybe some days they'll say, if you drive today, we guarantee you'll make $30 an hour. But the reason it's less good is because it makes it very hard to plan out your future earnings, right? Because you don't know how much you're going to earn every week if more of that money is coming from one-time offers and bonuses and sort of incentives that you have to chase down.
So what type of I'm talking about people who choose this type of work, who choose the gig economy, not folks who got laid off and they have to drive for Uber to help pay the rent or the mortgage, but folks who choose this line of work. What drives them? What type of person wants this kind of lifestyle, the uncertainty that you just mentioned?
Right. So the big advantage is that it's very flexible. Gig economy work, definitionally, you are an independent contractor. You're your own boss. You set your own hours. You can fit it in around other jobs. If you have kids you have to take care of, you can do it while they're at school. It is an extremely flexible job, and it's very much up to you.
Younger, older folks, is there an age breakdown? Is it more of the millennial generation that likes this flexibility? Didn't say it older folks.
It again depends on the platform. So on something like Airbnb, they've actually seen a lot of older people come on, which again makes sense if you think about it, right? Because people who are further along in life are more likely to have a home, have the money to buy a home. Maybe their kids have moved out, grown up, gone to college, and they have empty space and are renting out their apartment. In gig work, it's sort of all over the map. There are some younger people and millennials. The stereotype is very much a millennial, a person who bounces between jobs and strings everything together. But I don't know how true that stereotype is.
I also read that more folks who are taking advantage of this economy are married. And my guess is that one spouse has a full-time job with benefits and the other spouse can more or less freelance to work around childcare and other issues. So what's in it for the employer? I mean, we all hear that hiring and training employees is one of the most expensive things that a company can do. But if you have a constant churn of employees, why does an employer choose this?
Right. So it's a great question. And there's sort of this debate as to whether a company can save more money by hiring people as contractors, which allows you to pay them less because there's no required minimum wage. It also means you don't have to provide benefits. But like you said, those people are likely to become unhappy, churn off the platform. You have to replace them. That's very expensive. You also can't train them. So the place where this is really interesting to look at is sort of those cleaning companies I was talking about. In New York, we have one called Handy, which does everyone as a contractor. And then there's another one called Managed by Q, which does sort of office cleanings and management and other handyman type jobs. And Managed by Q hires people as employees and Handy hires people as contractors. And it sort of remains to be seen which philosophy will win out. But it's a very interesting progression to watch.
So if you're hiring a contractor through an app, mm-hmm. that to me seems pretty risky. How do I know that this person knows what they're doing, that they can hook up my wires correctly or fix my clogged drain correctly? I mean, what kind of quality control do these companies have to offer?
Most of these companies run online background checks that sort of do basic general background check stuff. But that said, there's been a lot of debate in the last couple of years whether the background checks are sufficient or if they should be using stricter ones that check in more registries and are more comprehensive before these people come online to work for whatever online platform.
What are the predictions? I mean, the economy is recovering more slowly than folks would hope or expect. But, you know, at some point that we'll get to full employment and wages will increase, we hope anyway. Does this gig economy go away? Is this a fad?
Well, I think a lot of it's going to depend on consumer demand. So even if people don't always love driving for Uber, as long as people love taking Uber, then it will probably be worth it to the company to continue making the job appealing enough that there are people who will provide the service, if that makes sense.
Yep.
And recently, you've sort of seen a trend among these companies to start being better to their workers. So Uber recently rolled out a bunch of new features to attract drivers. They added tipping, which was something that all drivers had asked for years, and Uber had sort of adamantly refused to add. And then they also added a bunch of other tweaks about how they do their ratings, how a driver gets paid if someone is late, how items are returned, things like that. And I think as the market picks up in jobs, like you're saying, the companies are going to just have to do more to make sure theirs are still attractive.
But the part-time, you know, on-the-side job is here to stay, probably. I mean, it always has been, but now with technology, it makes it even more permanent.
I think so.
Allison Griswold, she's a reporter for Quartz, covering the sharing economy, also known as the gig economy. Thanks for joining us here on All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll talk about what it takes to be a gig worker, what steps you need to take to make sure you get health insurance, for example, when All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. We're talking about the changing American workforce, the so-called gig economy. It's growing and becoming a major source of jobs now. It changes how people plan for the future. Most contract or gig jobs do not come with benefits or retirement plans. For some, that's liberating. For others, it's terrifying. Financial planner Rob Levy focuses on helping people in the gig economy plan for the future. He joins us right now. Rob, welcome to All Sides.
Thanks so much. Happy to be here.
And also with us is Alastair Fitzpain, executive director of the Future of the Workforce Initiative, a think tank designed to help Americans in the independent workforce. Alastair, welcome to All Sides.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Alastair, we'll start with you. You work for the Future of the Workforce Initiative. What is the future of our workforce?
That's a complex question, but I do think you are seeing with the number of people who are now working in the gig economy and obtaining work through online platforms that you are seeing a change that I think is going to continue to grow with each passing year. The latest data that we've seen suggests that 1% of our workforce is now obtaining some form of work through online platforms, but that's increased about 47 times relative to the number of people who used to do that in 2012. And according to the JP Morgan Institute, this is the fastest growing segment of the workforce, and we expect that to continue.
What is it, technology that's driving this workforce expansion, this part-time workforce expansion, or is it the economy and the lack of good full-time, well-paying jobs that's pushing this?
Yeah, I think it's both. I think technology obviously plays a huge role in just creating a new way that people can obtain work. And I think the advent of the smartphone combined with the new labor platforms that have been created to effectively take advantage of that. I mean, it just wasn't the case 15 years ago that you could take your phone into a car and use that as a way to obtain additional work. And that has now changed. And the model's been replicated over and over again, whether it's people that are doing handyman services, whether they're providing care, whether they're driving, or obviously Airbnb is kind of a new model for it as well in terms of people who want to share their houses.
Now, we talk about the technology, and of course, with Uber and Lyft, that really is a radically changing technology that has really opened up a new business, a new industry, on-demand ride sharing. But you look at other sectors that are using apps now, handymans you mentioned, even like substitute teaching now. We used to get a call from the principal at your house at 5 in the morning that they needed a sub. Now there's an app for that on the phone.
Right.
I mean, is it technology creating jobs or technology shifting to help folks who have been doing these jobs for decades find work?
Well, I think it's probably doing a little bit of both. I think it's helping people find jobs that they wouldn't have otherwise been able to find on their own. And I think it's also potentially creating new opportunities for, people, again, to connect with individuals who want to buy their services. Etsy is another example that we could talk about, right, where people who are producing arts and crafts now have the ability to sell to a much larger audience than they would have before. But I think you should go back to didn't answer the first question fully, which is, you asked, is it technology or is it the economy that's changing? And again, I think technology is playing a big role, but I do think the economy is also changing in some important ways. One is, again, more and more people are finding a hard time kind of getting full-time, what's called, you know, traditional work where you have a job at a company or a government or where you have benefits and you work 40 hours a week. And as those jobs become fewer and fewer in our economy, the you know, individuals are trying to supplement their wages or make, you know, earn income however they can, and taking advantage of these opportunities that didn't exist before just to potentially supplement their income.
Let's bring in Rob Levy. He is the managing director at the Center for Financial Services Innovation. Rob, you work directly with these folks who are a part of this gig economy. Describe the average person that you deal with. I mean, are they entrepreneurs or are they folks trying to supplement their income?
So I think the first place to start is to actually recognize that this trend that's happening in the gig economy is actually part of a broader trend in the whole economy, right? So over the last 30, 40 years or so, you've seen not just the growth of the gig economy, but you've also seen the decoupling of traditional benefits from traditional full-time employers, right? So that less and less, you know, we switch from the defined benefit to defined contribution and, you know, more part-time workers that now don't get health insurance benefits. And so whether you're full-time or you're a gig economy worker, I actually think you're more on your own than ever before, which gives you greater responsibility over managing your own financial health than ever before. Sort of the old American dream that if you just got that full-time job, most things would be taken care of you from healthcare to retirement. That dream is sadly over. And so there's now more responsibility on the individual, wherever you work, to manage your own financial health so that if things get bad and, you know, there's an emergency, you can handle it. And that hopefully you can, you know, improve your life over time towards the opportunities that you're seeking.
So this seems, in some ways, it could be empowering for the employee in that he's or she is not dependent on, you know, the plant to take care of them until and past their retirement. But on the other hand, there's a lot of insecurity there, uncertainty there. Rob?
There's a ton of uncertainty. Yeah, absolutely. I think the biggest thing that we're seeing is this growing uncertainty. And I think net-net, it's worse for the consumer, it's worse for the individual, and worse for the American household, because there's just so much to manage. And while there's some people, and, you know, like myself, who's an expert in financial services, and maybe I can manage all these pieces, I'll say it's even hard for me to know if I've got the right renter's insurance and the right this and that. For the person that's living paycheck to paycheck, which is, you know, potentially a third of all Americans, managing all these things is just really hard. They just don't have the bandwidth for it. So I actually think there is a responsibility on the employer, whether that's a full-time employer or someone like Uber or Lyft, to support and help their employees or their workers with offering them services and solutions that can help manage their financial health. And that's where technology, I think, is really perhaps both the problem and the solution, and that there are a lot of apps and tools out now that allow people to save easily, to access credit affordably, to make payments quickly. And that can make their lives a little easier. And I think the employer can be a conduit for those kinds of services to people that need it.
We're talking about the gig economy, the part-time, the contract economy. Uber is the classic example of this. Folks who are making money through technology to supplement their income sometimes as their full-time job. An email from Randy. Randy writes, I am in my mid-30s and I run a small business completely online through Etsy and eBay. I have worked online since 2009, which has allowed me to help care for a child with Asperger's. I enjoy the freedom of my employment, but there are drawbacks such as no health insurance, higher taxes, no wage protections, etc. Randy writes, I think that the peer-to-peer economy is going to be the economic path for the future, but it is an economic path that has no safety net for the employees. Alistair Fitzpain from the Future of Work Initiative, that's the story right there. Flexibility to care for a child who needs care, but there's the safety net is thin.
Yeah, and I guess just throw a couple numbers as part of the conversation. McKinsey Global Institute did an estimate and found that there's 32 million Americans who are earning their primary income from independent work. So it sounds like Randy, but then in addition, there's another 36 million who do independent work on a supplemental basis. So there are large numbers of Americans who are accessing independent work in different ways. Some as the source of their primary income, and others as a source of the supplemental income. And I think what's What's interesting is that some of the survey research that's been done, and again, this was McKinsey Global Institute finding, was that the majority of independent workers, both in the supplemental and the primary category, pursued that path out of preference rather than necessity. So I think there are plenty of Americans to the because of the pressures that have been put on wages over the last 20 to 30 years who are doing it out of necessity. But you do find that there's lots of people who are working independently who do enjoy it and think it's, you know, have a preference to doing it, to working that way, as opposed to working as part of a traditional company.
Alistair, is there any data on the demographics of this, of these folks who are doing it out of preference, their age, their marital status, their income levels? Has there been any research from McKinsey or others on what the demos are?
Yeah, you know, you see it more kind of like on a company by company basis, and it does highlight one of the you know, kind of public policy imperatives in this area is the need to get better information. The Department of Labor hasn't done, but has restarted something called the Contingent Worker Supplement that would really provide the kind of first look at what's happening in this sector of the workforce. They discontinued it in 2005, and they just made a decision this year or last year that it should be coming out this year to republish that information. But I'll just give you an example. You know, one of the biggest companies, Airbnb, which obviously started in 2009, you know, the average age of people who are working at Airbnb is like 43 years old. They make $6,000 per year. But the fastest growing population of people who are working for Airbnb or using Airbnb services are, you know, people who are like over the age of 60.
Interesting. Rob Levy from the Center for Financial Services Information. What advice do you have for someone who is looking to do this? Is perhaps working 9 to 5 in a job that's good, but it's not for them, and they want to venture out into this gig economy? What's the first thing they should do?
Well, I think the person who's making that choice on their own is in a little bit of a good position. And just to clarify, the Center for Financial Services Innovation, we're really focused on those consumers who are the most financially struggling, and okay, perhaps the one who aren't necessarily making this out of choice, but out of a bit of necessity.
I see.
Alistair was saying, yeah, and I think the key point here is around this. What you were talking earlier around uncertainty and volatility, right? So for about 1/3 of Americans, they encounter variation in their income month to month of a significant amount. That's from the JPMorgan Chase Institute. And a majority of those people are full-time employees, right? So it's full-time employees, but it's not necessarily a guaranteed 40-hour week paycheck. And this is another place where technology has really played a role. So the ability of employers, particularly fast food kind of restaurants and retail workers, who have a real need to upshift and downshift depending on consumer demand, technology has allowed them to do that really easily. And so you could say this is a benefit for the economy and those businesses can be more efficient. But the result is there's a lot of employees, and these are especially low-wage workers here, who are, you know, don't know how many hours they're going to have next week and in some case tomorrow, right? So that kind of volatility, yeah, is just incredibly hard to plan for. And if you're in that sort of situation, you need to be even more actively planning for yourself so that when, you know, when things go bad, you've got a little bit of reserve to tap into, and that when things are better, you know, don't just necessarily spend that money, but put that money away. And that can be very hard to do.
Yeah, it's putting a nest egg away and that kind of thing to try to bridge the gap of a slow week, you know. We're talking about this gig economy. 614-292-8513 is the number to call. We want to hear from you. If you are a member of this gig economy, are you piecing together a couple part-time jobs? Do you drive for Uber or Lyft? Or are you an employer? Someone who hires folks who on a contract basis, you choose to meet your customers' demands through this part-time work, through apps or through technology. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Alistair, health insurance and benefits, that's a huge issue. Many people stay in full-time jobs because of the benefits, even if they don't like them. How do folks in this gig economy, do they cope with that? I mean, we have the exchange. We have alternatives out there we didn't have a few years ago. But how are they coping with it?
Yeah, I mean, you put your finger on it. I think Rob touched on it as well, is that, you know, the upside, I think, of this trend in the economy is the flexibility, but the downside is the lack of access to health care and retirement. And you could also add to that list unemployment insurance and workers' compensation, the whole set of benefits that traditional employees enjoy if they work at a, you know, an employer that provides the set of benefits that, you know, again, are being kind of subsidized by the federal government. And so I think the answer to your question, though, is, you know, on health care, I think the Affordable Care Act has provided a meaningful avenue for individuals in this workforce to access health care. The Treasury Department and Health and Human Services at the end of the Obama administration did a study that showed that small businesses and self-employed were about one-fifth of the people who were participating in the marketplace in 2014. And I think, you know, on retirement, you know, there's a whole set of challenges, even for people who are working for employers that provide retirement benefits in terms of people making contributions to their retirement benefits. But I think it's a particularly acute problem for people who are working at the gig economy because you don't have an employer that's effectively providing a match, which is a strong incentive for people to make contributions.
Rob or Alistair, whoever can answer this, what happens if you work for a house cleaning service and you slip and fall on a wet floor? What happens to you? Who files that workers' comp claim? Is there a workers' comp claim?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an important question. I think for many people, again, if you are working as an independent contractor, you don't have the ability to file a workers' comp claim because you don't have an employer necessarily that's providing or participating in the workers' comp program, because that's, again, a benefit like health care and retirement that is provided to traditional employees and not independent workers. So you have many people who fall through the cracks in that regard.
So, Rob, you buy your own workers' compensation insurance, and if you're making a low wage job, you probably can't afford that, right, Rob?
Yeah, I think that's a real. Oh, yeah, absolutely, and especially depending on like where the payments fall. Is that something you pay every month, or what we've seen in our research is payments, particularly insurance premiums, that can something you know be like an every 6 month payment. Car insurance, for example, can be particularly difficult for people that are who are living paycheck to paycheck to budget and save for. The one thing I'll say, though, is that there are actually some good examples of employers, even in the home care field, which you're talking about, who are really thinking about their employees' financial health and financial wellness. One example I know from in New York, where I'm based, is the Cooperative Home Care Associates, who's partnered with a great organization called Neighborhood Trust that brings in financial coaches to their centers and makes appointments with those home care workers to help them budget and save and manage some of these things, because those people really need advice, particularly from a trusted source. So there are some good employers, whether it's of gig workers or full-time employers, that are starting to think about what can we do to help our employees with these challenges that they have.
Can I add one too? Because also in New York, there's a fund called the Black Car Fund, where for black car drivers in New York, customers pay an additional fee that allows black car drivers to access workers' compensation.
So here's what the private sector is sort of another business opportunity in this gig economy. Alistair, one more question. Alistair Fitzbain from the Future of Work Initiative. You held some high-level jobs in the federal government, Department of Health and Human Services, Treasury Department. What is the government's role in this? You touched on it a little bit earlier, but what is the government's role, if any, in regulating this economy?
Well, I think the government does have an important role to kind of recognize, again, that the economy is shifting in a pretty dramatic way. I mean, if you think about the way that the federal government subsidizes health care, there's $260 billion per year in employer-provided subsidies for health care. There's $140 billion in subsidies for employer-provided retirement. And I think that made sense in the 50s and 60s and 70s, again, when most people were working for traditional employers. But again, as the economy shifts, I think the policymakers need to think about how if health care and retirement and unemployment insurance and workers' compensation are public policy objectives that they believe workers should have access to, they need to figure out how to spread the benefits of those types of safety net programs to all sides of the workforce, not just traditional workers.
All right.
I couldn't agree more.
That's Rob Levy and Alistair Fitzbain, both experts in this gig economy. Rob Levy is the managing director at the Center for Financial Services Innovation. Alistair Fitzbain is the executive director of the Future of Work Initiative. Thanks to you both for joining us here on All Sides. When we come back, we'll take a look at what's happening here in Columbus. How is the gig economy working here in Central Ohio? When All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. We are talking about the future of work in America. Ohio has always been an indicator of the nation's economy. Jobs in Ohio are changing, as are jobs around the country. More and more people here in Ohio are losing manufacturing and factory jobs, and they're turning to the independent workforce to make a living. Ohio State University professor David Staley runs a group called the Columbus Futurists. As the name would suggest, the group focuses on the future of Columbus and the city's economy as a whole. Professor Staley, welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Before we get to the future of Columbus's economy, what's the current status of the gig economy in Central Ohio?
So I want to say thriving, and I assume that's a good thing for most listeners. The gig economy can be thought of, I think, in sort of two ways. The positive way is that I think that there's a number of young people today, millennials, 20, 30-somethings, who I think choose to participate in the gig economy, meaning, interested in part-time gigs or jobs that last, a week, even a day in some cases, because they like that flexibility. They like being able to engage in a number of tasks. It fits in with an important part of their lifestyle. That said, I think that there's another dimension to that economy, including those who don't want to participate, at least willingly participate in such an economy. And these are people who can't have access, or there aren't any full-time or the sorts of jobs that we would think of sort of traditionally, salary jobs, or even traditional working blue collar jobs. And so I think that the gig economy is growing, and whether that's a good thing or not, I think depends on your circumstance.
Do you know any idea what the breakdown is between folks who are choosing this economy and folks who are working this out of necessity?
I don't. I wish I did. I think that would be a really critical data set to consider.
Do you see this? Is it here to stay, or is it a fad? Is it here while the economy is still recovering and then it'll disappear? Or is this freelance world something we're all going to have to deal with for decades to come?
Boy, that's a terrific question, Mike. I think it will continue to exist. The question is, what's its size and scope going to be? I suppose even before we coined the term gig economy, There were those whose jobs were defined by those sort of part-time or of short duration sorts of jobs. So, for instance, a couple of weeks ago, I hired a handyman to do a couple of tasks around my home. Technically, I guess that's a kind of gig economy. He comes in, he performs a task, and then he's off to the next one. He works for himself. Those sorts of jobs, I think, have been around for a while. And so, when you ask, is this a fad? Is this going to continue? I think it absolutely will. The question is, what's its scope going to be? Is everybody going to be engaged in the gig economy, or will there be a growing number of people?
Yeah. Let's take a couple of calls. Let's go to Nancy from Columbus.
Overall economy. I think it's going to grow, personally.
Okay. Let's try Nancy here. Go ahead, Nancy. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes, this is Nancy. I have been doing it for a long time. The gig economy has gone up and down depending on what's happening.
What is your profession, Nancy?
I'm a Right now I'm a grant writer. I started doing freelance writing and editing, and then I'd take on projects that were like project management for book projects that a lot of different companies would farm something out like that. This was in 1997 through about 2005. And then we had the recession, and that made it really hard. But also, like right now, the healthcare fight that's been going on, there are a lot of hospitals, for instance, that aren't making decisions. They're holding off. And I have a client, one of my bigger clients hires me to do some hiring. I do freelance hiring of, for instance, a person who would be a program director for a residency program. And we've been doing this as a team. When I work with that client, they're the ones who go out and get the job. They just hire me for this one part of what that is. Mm-hmm. And that was held off all the way through the election because there was always this, if Trump wins, it's going to be one thing. If Hillary wins, it'll be another thing. They don't know if Obamacare is going to last. They just got used to it. And now they still don't know what's really going to happen with it. It made them hold off on their decision-making. So while we had many irons in the fire, nobody would, pull the trigger and hire us. So I had to start doing something else. I couldn't count on that. And then thankfully I have a background. I'm pretty old. I'm 65. So, right now I am. Yeah. Last year, that was a problem. So I went and got a job as a site director at a before and after school program.
Okay.
And I could work in that. And I've always had that. I could go back to substitute teaching if I had to.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you, Nancy. David, how common is that story? Here you have a more experienced worker towards the end of her career, just piecing together gigs to make a living until she can retire.
So I think Nancy said that she'd been doing that she'd been a grant writer since 1997.
Yes.
Before we started using the term gig economy, I think we called people like that consultants.
Yes.
And
or freelance.
Or freelance.
Yeah.
And that's why I say that these sorts of jobs have always been, or certainly have been for a number of decades, I think, a part of me. I think one of the things that might distinguish a gig economy is that people who engage in that sort of work aren't doing just sort of work. So I'm not just a freelance, say, grant writer or something, but, maybe it's grant writing today, maybe it's some other sort of task next week, maybe I'm going to be working on some other sort of even different sort of task 3 months from now. And I think that's one of the things that distinguishes what we call sort of traditional consultancy and gig economy.
Yeah. What's in it for the employer? I mean, hiring and training employees is expensive. Mm-hmm. So why would you want a constant churn of gig workers, freelance workers doing work for your company when you can hire the right person, train that person, and keep them for 10 years?
Flex, I think, is probably the simplest answer to it. And you're absolutely right. The way you described that, I think, is absolutely right. You're making an investment in that worker.
David, you still there? Oh, we seem to have lost David. So while we wait for David to get back on the line, we do have another call from Rich from Columbus. Rich, you're on All Sides with Ann Fisher. What's your story in this gig economy?
Yeah, in 2007, 2008, I took a delivery job using my own van, my own insurance, and basically after taxes, I barely paid for the van. I was working for free, but it was cash flow. But to survive the recession, thanks to the financial collapse. But the big question I have for Uber and lots of other things, and after having driven this delivery van, is I don't know if the gig economy is going to work if the repair guy just can't pay for his tools. The guy that's driving, chews up his car with a lot of miles, has to repair or replace it. I don't think that in the calculations from these companies that they're actually calculating the true cost of driving that car. And maybe, as one of your speakers had said, people aren't calculating the cost of insurance and repairs and all kinds of other costs, health costs.
Yeah.
And I think that, this has been a massive, massive externalization of costs onto the individual, onto society from corporations. And it's going to crash, I think, because just from the fact, yeah, you may need cash flow, but if you don't have the capital to replace.
Oh, I think we lost our caller there, but there was a typical illustration of someone coping with this gig economy, having to pick up some of the costs that his employer would have picked up. Paul, David, if you hadn't heard that, the man was saying that who's gonna pay for the repairs to the car if you're an Uber driver? Who's going to pay for the maintenance to tools if you're a handyman working on your own? That's an issue that folks have to face. David, are you there? Apparently not. Maybe we have a gig economy on the phones this afternoon or this morning. So we're talking about the gig economy here in Central Ohio, the growing issues with folks who are freelancing, trying to cobble together some jobs to make a living. Some people are doing it out of necessity. They perhaps lost their manufacturing job. They perhaps lost their job at an office, and now they are just trying to piece together part-time work to make a living, to pay the bills. Then there are folks who are doing this by choice. They like the flexibility of not having a boss permanently. They like the flexibility of being able to take care of their kids at home during the day and work in the evenings, perhaps. Or they like the flexibility of working remotely, or the change of always having a new project to work on and not having to slog to the same office every single day. If you have a story for us, we just have a couple minutes left, 614-292-8513, or give us an email, send us an email at allsides@wosu.org. The gig economy is here, and we would like to see how if it will last. And David Staley, history professor at Ohio State University, is with us. He's president of a group called Columbus Futurists. So, David, you do see this type of work continuing?
I do, yes. And I think part of a broader trend worldwide about sort of more and more people becoming the technical term, I guess, is precarity, or being more precarious, being in more precarious sort of economic circumstances. And we see it's not just in this country. We're seeing this in Western Europe and other parts of the world as well. I think part of the debates around healthcare, for instance, I mean, we see it there in the debates about healthcare. You know, are people sort of responsible for their own health insurance? Is this something that that state should provide? But I think that underlying some of those debates is the question about sort of the precariousness of jobs.
So in a country where the healthcare is paid for by the government, are there more gig workers there because they don't have to worry about employer based health insurance?
I don't know if there are any more or less than you'd find anyplace else. Although I think it makes the gig economy easier. It greases the wheels, I think, more than what you'd find, say, in this country.
Is Columbus? How does this vary geographically across this country? Are there any parts of the country where there are more folks doing this than others? And how does Columbus compare to, say, New York, San Francisco, or even like Kansas City or St. Louis?
Yeah, I think the comparison is to San Francisco. I think especially in tech industries, this is where we see the gig economy really heating up around technology. And part of it has to do, I think, not just simply with the industry, but the way that industry is put together. There really is, in San Francisco, there's a technology ecosystem, so that it's much easier for a worker to be able to leap between different companies. You have a kind of a skill set that you hone at, say, Oracle, and you know, take that to Google. And so I think you really see in a place like San Francisco. I don't know the sort of ecosystem that we have around any particular industry in Columbus. It might be around data and information, OCLC, Chemical Abstracts, the Data Analytics Center they're developing at IBM.
Mm-hmm. The Amazon facility that's opening up data center here.
Exactly, yes. And so where there's a vibrant ecosystem, I think that's where you see more instances of the gig economy.
Yeah, and there are jobs you haven't even thought of that are going to pop up. I mean, Uber was a totally different thing 5 years ago compared
that's
to what
a, that's a whole other conversation, I think, about the jobs that are going to happen. And
yeah.
You're absolutely right.
We haven't even thought about it.
That's right.
All right. David Staley, he's Associate Professor of History at Ohio State and President of the Columbus Futurists. Thanks for joining us here on All Sides. We'd also like to thank, special thanks to our intern, Owen Daugherty, for producing this hour of All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.